Hi everybody, welcome to Enlightenment Today. It's Jason here. In this episode, we'll be speaking about yoga, what yoga is and also what yoga isn't. Okay, so when most people hear the word yoga, what do we usually think of? Most people think of physical postures. Most people think of wearing very revealing clothes to the yoga classes to look more attractive for other people. People think about looking physically fit. Now, this is more of a materialist yoga that has developed over the hundreds of years since it has been brought to the West, where we have taken only the superficial aspects of yoga and applied them to our society. Now, to understand a bit more about that, you should watch my episode on the geography of mind, which gets a lot into why these sort of things would happen. But in regards to yoga, yoga is not a physical exercise, which most people think of. Now, that would actually make the great yogi masters roll in their grave, where they see people who are concerned about the way they physically look. Yoga is actually a spiritual tradition, and it is a gift from India to the world. It is more of an inward journey than an outward journey. Now, the physical exercise regime of the modern yoga, what we see in the modern world, is a poor cousin of Hatha yoga in traditional yoga. Now, Hatha yoga was actually a method to prepare for stillness meditation in the original classical yoga. So the modern yoga we see is more related to Pilates than anything of the spiritual nature. So that's what yoga is not, okay? I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. I actually would like people to get physically healthy and look after their well-being. But what I want people to understand is what they are practicing in the classes and in the gym mainly is not yoga, because a lot of the philosophy has been left out. A lot of the core understandings have been left out. And most people don't even know where yoga came from. Most people don't even know who Patanjali is. Now, to understand yoga, we need to go back in time, back to its foundations, nearly 2,000 years ago. So where did yoga originate? Yoga originated in the Yoga Sutras, a classical text which was compiled around 400 CE. Some scholars believe even earlier, in 200 CE. Now, the Yoga Sutras were compiled by the great sage Patanjali of India. Now, Patanjali is one of the greats in Eastern philosophy. He stands beside Gautama the Buddha and Shankara and other great sages. Now, what is the Yoga Sutras? Now, the Yoga Sutras is 196 compact observations on the nature of consciousness and spiritual liberation. That's what they are. They're a system of liberation and understanding this consciousness that we walk around with daily. Now, the word yoga in its original Sanskrit root comes from the Sanskrit root yug. Now, yug can be understood as union or yoke. You know, in the Bible, you often you hear Jesus say, "My yoke is easy." Now, Alan Watts said that meant, he meant, "My yoga is easy." So that means union, but it also means yoke. Now, what does it mean by yoke? Now, yoke means to extract your consciousness from the gravitational pull of external things. That's what it means. So yoga is meant to rein in the tendency of our mind and our consciousness to gravitate towards the external world. So we pull it back like a fishing line. Now, what this does is it reorientates our focus back within. So yoga, the yoking process, trains consciousness to turn inward toward itself to realize the true underlying essence of our awareness. Now, the true underlying essence of our awareness is called Purusha in Sanskrit. And Purusha is the pure awareness which is not identified with anything in the world. Okay. So Patanjali believes that everything that exists in the universe is different from Purusha, from pure awareness. So the contents, even the contents that make up consciousness, are separate from Purusha. So this is part of the core philosophy of yoga. So to understand Purusha better, you need to understand Purusha's counterpart, which is Prakriti. So Now, to explain Purusha and Prakriti, first of all, Prakriti is translated as nature. Now, don't think of the trees, the birds, the bees, the water, so forth and so on. That is part of it. But Prakriti, according to Patanjali, is everything that exists, even within us, even our emotions, our intuition, the deepest inmost parts of ourself is part of Prakriti. Now, the opposite of that is Purusha, is pure awareness. Now, pure awareness is, according to Patanjali, is purely unstained. It doesn't identify with anything. It is completely beyond time, separate from time. It had no birth and it will have no death. It's the eternal aspect that is within us. Now, this is similar to the Vedanta notion of Atman in Sanskrit. Now, Atman is the non-dual self, the undifferentiated consciousness within us that is identical to Brahman, the absolute ultimate reality. So Purusha is divorced from that. And Patanjali's yoga is about identifying with Purusha more, because then you loosen the grip of Prakriti. Now, this is what defines yoga different from some of the other traditions in the Vedic culture, from Vedanta and Samkhya. Because when we look at Prakriti and Purusha, they are not actually apart. Patanjali is saying that Purusha stands outside actually of Prakriti, but Prakriti is sort of our pure awareness gets wound up in the whirlwinds of Prakriti, and our mind then begins to be attracted to externality and so forth and so on. So in relation to a whirlwind, when we look at Prakriti can be also translated as motion, the motion of the universe, all of the energy and matter and mind, all like a tornado mixing together. And a lot of us experience that within our consciousness. And the stillness aspect is Purusha. So when the mind is completely still, it is exactly like it is Purusha. Now, Patanjali uses a jewel as an analogy to define these two, but there's also other better analogies. Water is a better analogy in some sense than a jewel, because when we look at the two essential aspects of water, which is water is transparent and water is reflective. Now, what does that mean? It means that when the water, when the surface of the water is disturbed, we can't see into the water. We can't see the image of the water and we can't see deep into the water. But when the water becomes perfectly still, we can move inward and we can see what's within the water. Now, that's an analogy for how Prakriti and Purusha dance with each other. When we bring the vibrations of the mind completely still, then we can begin to come into resonance with Purusha. We begin to bring our mind into stillness. Now, this is explained in one of the most key phrases in the Yoga Sutras, and a lot of people are probably familiar with it in Sanskrit. It means, it is Chitta Vritti Niroda, okay? Now, Chitta Vritti Niroda, translated into English, means bringing the whirlwinds of mind back to stillness. So bringing the whirlwinds of mind back to stillness. This is the point of yoga and the Yoga Sutras and what traditionally Patanjali was promoting for other people to practice. Now, so how do we bring the whirlwinds of mind back to stillness? So the original yoga, we have to understand the root of the word asana. A lot of people think the word asana means physical practice, means something like this. It means physical practice, so forth and so on. But asana actually means, translated in English, means to sit or seat, or actually sitting posture. This is what it originally means, and this is why you find it in the Yoga Sutras. So Patanjali belief that when we bring the doing aspect of ourselves back into non-doing, back into stillness meditation, which you still see practiced around the world, then we have the process of yoga. We have the process of union, of yoking our consciousness to that which we cannot explain. Now, as we have evolved over time, over the last few thousand years, that aspect from original yoga, which is stillness meditation, to now, there's been an evolution, and there are actually seven paths of yoga now. So the seven paths of yoga are actually have evolved because of different archetypes with people, different temperaments with people. Okay, so we mentioned Hatha yoga before. So Hatha yoga is the yoga of forceful effort. This is why you see the modern exercise regime of a yoga mimics Hatha yoga, where you see a lot of forceful effort in physical postures. This is about cultivating an adamantine body. And as I said, Hatha yoga is actually more to do with preparing for stillness meditation. Think of it this way: when you exercise intensely, how do you feel straight after exercise? Your body is relaxed, all of your channels are open within your body, the prana is flowing throughout your system. And if you were to sit down after, say, running, for example, you'd be able to meditate very deeply. The second yoga is karma yoga. A lot of people are familiar with the word karma. Karma actually comes from the root Sanskrit kri, which means actually action. Now, karma yoga is found in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna advocates to Arjuna not to think too much about who he is going into battle with, but just to act without being concerned about the fruits of his action. That's why karma yoga is known as the yoga of selfless action, about just doing action without the sense of somebody being there. Now, the next yoga is bhakti yoga. Now, bhakti yoga is the yoga of devotion. This is one we commonly see in India especially. And actually, bhakti yoga is mainly what Christians and Muslims practice when we look at the science of the yogas. Now, mantra yoga is the yoga of sound or repetition. Mantra yoga, a lot of people practice kirtans and mantras and so forth and so on. The idea of this is to keep repeating it in your mind. That's why I say it's the yoga of repetition. You might see, if you go to Tiruvannamalai in southern India, when someone walks the 13 or 14 kilometer walk around the holy mountain of Arunachala, they'll be sitting there with their mala beads, walking slowly, reciting Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya. And this is not so much, you know, you can look at the superficial aspects of it and think that they are praising Shiva, the god, but if you look at the science of what they're doing, they are just practicing, that they're repeating a mantra to keep their mind in stillness. Now, the next yoga is Tantra. Now, Tantra is the yoga of inner technology. Now, this is a very popular yoga in the world, and it's been only seen in a superficial context, which is usually only one aspect of Tantra yoga, where people think that it's to do with having sex and so forth and so on. But Tantra yoga is more orgasmic than sexual, meaning it's about understanding your complete system of your psychosomatic organism. It's about taking your awareness from the lower chakras up to the higher chakras. And to understand the system in Tantra, you have to understand the divine feminine, Shakti in Sanskrit, and also how prana moves through the body, and how that divine feminine, when we take in the masculine and feminine aspects within our psychosomatic organism, how we can rise that up the spine into the higher centers. You know, a lot of people call this the Kundalini. Okay, this is Tantra yoga. It's the science of inner technology of yoga. And it's very complex, and it actually has nothing to do with having sex with other people. Now, another yoga is Raja yoga. Now, people translate this as royal yoga, and it's sometimes attributed to Patanjali's eightfold path of meditative introversion. Okay, so most people identify it with that, but Raja yoga can also be understood as controlling the mind to reach the empty place of samadhi. So, meaning to control your mind so deeply that you get to the deeper levels of samadhi. Samadhi can mean meditative absorption, concentration, so forth and so on. Now, the next yoga, the last yoga, I should say, is Jnana yoga. Now, Jnana yoga is the yoga of wisdom or knowledge. Now, this is what is practiced by some of the great sages, the great yogis, the great sadhus. Now, this is the Jnana Yoga is the wisdom of deep contemplation. So the wisdom we acquire from contemplating deeply. A lot of people believe that Jnana Yoga is the elite yoga. It's like the top of the seven yogas, Hatha being the first. I'm not going to agree with that. I'm still going to say that these are temperaments and people are attracted to certain aspects of different parts of yoga. But Jnana Yoga is closely related and actually almost identical with Vedanta when we look at Vedanta philosophy, and we look at the especially Advaita Vedanta, non-dualism, and we see that always in our consciousness we should always discern between the real and the unreal within ourselves, meaning not identifying with the separate aspects that we project in our mind onto external things and how we think about the world separately, always staying in Atman or Purusha in this sense. So you just have to think about Ramana Maharishi to think about a great Jnani. And that is kind of the essence of Jnana Yoga embodied when you look at his life. So these seven paths of yoga evolved over time, and they came from the original yoga, which we always need to come back to. Patanjali's original yoga was stillness yoga. Asana means to sit or sitting posture. Okay. So, in saying all that, when we look at everything of yoga, when we look at the way that we practice it today, you know, it's a good idea to dive deeply into the core philosophy of yoga, what Patanjali was actually teaching, if you are serious about it. Now, if you are serious about it, I have three books that I recommend. First is obviously the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali. Now, the Yoga Sutras, there are many great translations. I like this one by Chip Hartranft, but there are other beautiful ones. There's one by Swami Satchidananda, which is excellent. Georg Fuersten has wrote an exceptional one. These are all great, but this is one of my personal favorites and one I recommend. Now, speaking of Georg Fuersten, he is one of the foremost scholars of yoga, and I recommend actually any book of his. First of all, you need to think about this one, Yoga Tradition. People often call this the yoga phone book for obvious reasons, but this is what I recommend. This is a deep, deep read, and it will take you a long time to read. It'll take your mind a while to absorb it, but I really recommend it if you're serious about yoga. And then when you get through that, I recommend one of his other books. And this was actually his last book before he passed away. And this is The Psychology of Yoga. This is a great read and more for deeper practitioners of yoga. But these three books in themselves, I highly recommend if you are serious about the yoga tradition and what it means. And what yoga really means, it doesn't mean looking physically fit. It means extracting your mind from the idea of separateness back into the idea of pure unstained awareness, Purusha. So that's it today, folks. I'll see you next time, and continue to take your yoga practice deeper.